So a little over 20 years ago, in an office in Lower Manhattan at 11 Broadway, which is the headquarters of the Orthodox Union, three meat producers, three Gentiles, gathered in a conference room at the OU. They were invited there. They were having a meeting with Rabbi Menachem Ganak Shalita, who is the head of OU Kashrus. And they had some issue to bring up with Rabbi Ganak that they needed to discuss with him. And these meat processors, these three Gentiles, were there sitting in the room with a group of rabbis. And Rabbi Ganak asked these gentlemen to describe the process of how they produce veal. So these three unsuspecting gentlemen began to describe how they raise the calves, and then how they are slaughtered, and then how they're packaged. So as they're describing how they have a formula, which is a mixture of either tallow or lard and milk, and it's turned into powder, and it's cooked up with hot water, and then fed, bottle fed to these young calves, Rabbi Ganak looks over at some of the rabbis and starts speaking in a language that is not discernible to the Gentiles. But if you had a Gemara cup, you would know exactly what Rabbi Ganak was talking about. And this conversation kicked off a huge controversy regarding the kashrus of veal. Now, there had been a controversy regarding veal from years before, which we're going to get to at the end, based on a responsum of Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadok Livracha, about some aspects of veal. But this created a totally new controversy. And I heard this maisa from Mori Varabi, Rav Herschel Schechter Shalita, who was there in the room. And he said that the non-Jews described how basically they were cooking basar b'chalav, making it into formula, and giving it to these calves. And that created a whole series of halachic questions. So I started to do a little bit of research on this topic, and the metzias, that's a Hebrew term for the facts on the ground, or as we like to say, we're just looking, we just want just the facts, ma'am. So the facts were one set of facts in the 1980s, then there was another set of facts in the early 2000s, now things evolve. But the bottom line, if you look on the source, on the first page of your sources, and I took this straight from the USDA website, that calves are raised different than other cows. What calves are we talking about? Generally, the dairy cows that are raised in the United States are called Holstein cows. That's a type of cow, not a Hasidus. Holstein. They are a type of dairy cow. We are right next to the dairy capital of the world, so we could go and see some of these. But what happens when you have a dairy cow that gives birth to a zachar? So that zachar does not produce any milk. So it's not going to grow into a bull. It's not the right surah. Sometimes they'll be raised for breeding, but what they'll often do with the male offspring of the Holstein dairy cows is that they will raise them for veal. Veal is a type of beef which is, you'll know better than I, which is very soft. It has a light color, either a whitish color or a pinkish color, depending on exactly how it's raised, which is going to be a big nafgamina lemaisa we'll see soon. There are marmakomos packets in the back. So according to the USDA, the majority of veal calves you see here, this is the picture of a Holstein cow, at least that's what it's reported on the internet to look like, are special fed. So they explain what that means. A veal calf is raised until about 16 to 18 weeks of age, weighing up to 450 pounds, which is very lean for these types of animals, meaning a regular cow that you would shecht is going to be close to 1,000 pounds. They are raised in specially designated facilities where they can be cared for and monitored. These are called special or milk or formula. These are all names for a similar type of thing. Special fed, milk fed, formula fed are the names given to nutritionally balanced milk or soy-based diets fed to calves. These diets contain iron and 40 other essential nutrients, including amino acids, carbohydrates, fats, minerals, and vitamins. Well, what creates those proteins, those amino acids? What is it that they're looking for? They're looking for creating a delicious type of meat, which I think, if I understand it correctly, has very low muscle content. I think that is part of the issue here, that there's not a lot of muscle, and therefore the meat develops in a much softer way so that the muscles are not stark. I don't exactly know all the biology, and you have to talk to the shochtim. But that's the punchline of it, is that they don't want these animals roaming around, developing strong muscles, working in the field. They want them confined to a small area so that they develop very soft muscles. Very soft muscles. And you see, they're shechted very early on when they're small. So on one hand, you would say, if somebody were to ask you on the street, is there a kosher issue eating veal? You would say, well, veal comes from a kosher animal. It comes from generally from a Holstein cow, and it's slaughtered according to the halacha by a shochet. So what could be the problem of the veal? But now you're thinking to yourself, wait a second. Is there an issue with the fact that the animal was given a special diet from this type of formula, which has basar b'chalav? And that is the origins of this whole brouhaha that started in the early 2000s. That's the whole situation. That was how it all got started, was the realization that the feed, this formula, was a basar b'chalav derivative. So this question of what the food source is of the animal is rooted in a Mishnah in Maseches Temura. There are a lot of details of the sugya. We're going to try to keep it as clear and concise as possible, but there's more to talk about in each one. The Mishnah has a discussion about animals being acceptable as karbonos. So, for example, the Mishnah says, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Vlad Trefa lo yikar val gabi mizbeach. If you have an animal which is a trefa means it is sick with a specific ailment, which is enumerated in the Rambam based on the Gemara, and these specific ailments disqualify the animal, it makes it non-kosher. Usually we refer to something as treif, that's a Yiddishism, as something that is not acceptable to be eaten. Halachically, something which is a treifa means the animal has a particular disease or ailment that renders it not kosher. So for example, if you go to a schlachthaus, you've been to a schlachthaus before, right? We're in an area of the country where this was big, but you go to a schlachthaus, I've been to a few times. What they will do is, after they will slaughter an animal, let's say we talk about gassos, large animals like a cow, they would slaughter a cow. So there are different ways of doing this. I've seen different kinds. One is the hoist method, where they take the cow and they hoist it up to the ceiling by its leg. I'm not going to get too graphic for you, don't worry. And then after they shecht it, they take out the innards, they take the lungs, and either the shochet goes like this, you ever see such a thing? He blows up the lungs with his mouth. Or now they take a little hose that's like a bike tire hose. They stick it in and it inflates the lungs. Why do they do this? Because they want to check to make sure there are no holes in the lungs. Because if there's a hole in the lung, that makes the animal a trefa. Means the animal had this disease that had a punctured lung. They do this for every cow, which is why, by the way, to get a kosher meat product, it's actually extremely expensive. In your average slaughterhouse, we'll see at the end, only, let's say, around 20 or 30% of the animals which are shechted there turn out to actually be glatt kosher, because there are a lot of requirements. So when I was in 11th grade, so we learned chulin, and they decided to take a bunch of high school boys to see shechita, which was fascinating. And then after that, we went for lunch for hamburgers. Only 11th grade boys can do that. And then I went. We have a family. Our family has. We have cousins. They are the proprietors of a big supermarket in Brooklyn, and they actually get their meat from a meat processor that's not far from Baltimore. So they were once shechting. My father's cousin called us. They said they were shechting bison, if we wanted to come to the Schlachthaus and see this. So we went to the Schlachthaus, and this was a much bigger operation. And so you actually see a fascinating, the entire process of how they get the animals in there, how they shecht them, how they... And as someone who's very queasy, I was not expecting to manage this very well. And it was actually, shockingly, not maybe because it's not, you know, someone getting their finger cut open, which I can't really handle, but it was just an animal being cut into pieces. So anyway, you see when you go through the process of the bedikos, how they check these animals, that the vast majority of the animals do not pass kosher standards. So what happens to them is that the owner of the business, many times the owner of the business are not Jewish, but they have a shochet, shecht all the animals, and then whatever portion of it, 30% of it or so, they take those animals, they send them off to the kosher consumers, and the rest of it is non-kosher meat, so it gets sold to A&P or to whoever. So that's the standard process. You have to make sure that the animal is not a treifa. So if you have the vlad, the offspring of a treifa, the first opinion of the Mishnah is that that offspring is not kosher for a karban. Great. Comes Rabbi Chanina ben Antignos, in his opinion in the Mishnah, one of the Tanaim, kshera, if you have a kosher animal, she yonka min ha-treifa. Yonek means it nursed from a treifa. A treifa is not kosher. So you have a calf that nursed from the mother, which was a treifa. Says Rabbi Chanina ben Antignos, psula me'al gabe mizbeach. It is disqualified from being brought on the mizbeach. And the Gemara Daf Lamed Aleph wonders why this should be. And the Gemara's answer is that the case is that it was heinika cholav roseach mishachris l'shachris. It drank, this calf drank its mother's hot milk, literally meaning hot milk, but it means fresh milk, mishachris l'shachris, every day, from one day to the next. And Rashi answers, what does it mean, shachris l'shachris? Rashi says, kol yamav, its entire life. So apparently, according to Rabbi Chanina ben Antignos, if you have a calf that nursed, that drank milk from a treifa, and this is a whole discussion, not for this, but in Maseches Bechoros, about something which is derivative of something that's not kosher. So for example, bee honey. The Gemara has to have a drasha to teach you that bee honey is kosher because it's a derivative of non-kosher item. It's an insect. So how could you eat bee honey? So the Gemara has a special drasha to explain how that could be. But if you have milk that came from a treifa, you cannot drink it. This is why there's a whole other discussion, which is not for today, which is why there are, Rav Schechter is one of the select few people in the world who does not drink milk, because he is concerned that the milk that's in his glass derived from a treifa. Now, how could it be that he's worried about milk? People have been drinking milk from time immemorial. So from time immemorial, the way that they manufactured milk is if you were living in a shtetl, in Zmigre Judge, so you had three cows in the town, and of those three cows, you got milk, and we have a assumption, we have a working chazaka, rov behemos ksheros, most animals are kosher. But we know that from our experience that tons and tons of animals are trefos. So Rav Schechter is concerned that now, let's say, the big milk manufacturers, Dean's, like when you drive in Wisconsin, all these dairies, they all collect all their milk, and they all pool them together, so you have tons of milk that's from treifas in there. So how do you know? So you say it comes from a rove. Then you get a whole discussion with roves. I was once in the car. I asked Rav Schechter about this. He said he asked Rav Eliashiv about this three times, and Rav Eliashiv never gave him a satisfactory answer, so he doesn't drink milk. Rav Asher Weiss has a tshuva where he explains why we drink milk based on bittul and rove and anything. But it's the same principle. If the cow is not kosher, if the cow is a trefa, so you can't drink the milk of the cow. So now Rav Chanina ben Antigonos is saying that if the mother that's providing the milk is a trefa, then the derivative of that, the calf, is not kosher for the Mizbeach. So far, all we know from this Mishnah is, number one, it's the opinion of Rabbi Chanina ben Antigonos. We don't know what the Chachamim say. Number two, Rabbi Chanina ben Antigonos is talking about a case where you're offering this animal on the Mizbeach. At this point, that's all we know. The other thing is that Rashi's interpretation, which we'll see not everybody agrees with, is that the only thing, kol yamav, the only thing that this calf ate was this milk from the trefa. So it goes back to, you know, thinking about what the diet is. If you have a bird that might eat seeds and other things, that's going to be different than this calf that was exclusively drinking the mother's milk, and it was supervised. So now comes Tosfos. Tosfos on this page, look at Tosfos, says, Hu adin, it's also true, bekarshine avodas kochavim, if it ate legumes, beans of avodah zarah, let's say there was an idolater who served beans to an idol, those beans now become usur bahana'a, they are not allowed to be the source of any benefit. So this is a discussion of Maseches Avodah Zarah, Daf Memtes. So Tosfos says, you know, I know there's a Gemara Memtes. There the Gemara talks about Zev Zeh Goreim, which is when you have two different sources that contribute. So let's say an animal ate bird feed, and it also ate worms or something like that. So then you have two factors contributing. So Tosfos says, that's what the Gemara is talking about over there in Avodah Zarah, where the animal ate beans that were prohibited, and it ate also some other beans. But what if it only ate beans that were asur b'hana? So look at this Tosfos. Im achla kol yameha, Tosfos then says, she'ikar gdi losa mehen, that the main growth of the animal is from that. So now Tosfos just made a huge, huge leap. It went from that being the sole source of food to the main source of food, ikar gdilasa, that's a big, big chumrah. Shehu asur, that it is prohibited, and now comes the key line in Tosfos, ulafim riata, and at first glance, afilu lehedyot. Even for an ordinary person, this is prohibited. That is the line. Tosfos now took us from what the Mishnah said, which was about whether or not this is allowed to be a korban, to saying that this is not allowed for consumption for a regular person. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a very lengthy tshuva. I'll admit, I did not get through the whole thing. It's like 10, 12 pages. I didn't get through the whole thing. It's in the beginning of Orach Chaim. He says, the Achronim didn't deal with this too long, so he spends a ton, he has like 10 anafim, 10 sections in his tshuva to explain the Tosfos, and now the Tosfos whole fits with the Gemaras. But this Tosfos is the source of the expansion of the Mishnah beyond the scope of just Karbonos to everyday meat. And it's not just, Tosfos says, Karshini Avodazar, which are Asur Bahana, it's also this milk from a trefa. Now, this is Tosfos' opinion. Remember, Tosfos is living, this is a school of Chachamim who are living in the 12th century, 13th century, 14th century in France. But parallel to the Baal Yat Tosfos, you have the Chachmei Sfarad, you have the Rambam. The Rambam writes in the Pirush HaMishnayos here in source number 4, Vezesha Osa Rabbi Chanina ben Antigonos, this that Rabbi Chanina ben Antigonos, he said that it is Ksheira Shiyankam Natrefa, if you have a kosher animal that nursed from a non-kosher animal, who ba'oso hayom bilvad shiyanka. First of all, the Rambam says when it's Mishachas Ashachas means it's just that day. Not that it's entire life. No,
It doesn't matter what it did its entire life. It matters what it was today. Because you could supervise it today. And then it becomes digested, which is a whole other discussion based on the fact that it transformed into something else. Va'ad kan lo gnigmari pikulo. Avol, says the Rambam, im nisachel, if it was digested, third line in source number four, afilo haya zan osa derech mashal, even if you were to feed it, for example, bekarshinim shel avodazara, with legumes of idolatry. Who quoted that case in the Gemara in Avodazara? Tosfos did, and Tosfos was machmir. The Rambam says, even if you did that, ad shishmita b'tachas hashum, and you fattened it to the fattest of fat, harei muteres legabe mizbeach ledivrei hakol, it is mutter to the mizbeach for everyone. So first of all, the Rambam says, number one, this whole Mishnah is talking about what's happening today, before whatever the animal digested was decomposed. The Rambam thinks, once it's decomposed, it's now meat. It's transformed, which is a whole issue in what's called ikol. Then the Rambam says, this whole discussion, it's not true if it's after 24 hours, if it's not that day anymore. And then the Rambam says, ve'ein halacha k'rabbi Eliezer u'k'rabbi Chanina ben Tanur Tignos. And not only that, the Rambam says, number one, this whole halacha, it's only pertinent to karbanos. The Rambam does not say anything about a regular person eating it. Ad k'dikach, then the Rambam adds, and we don't paskin like it anyway. It's only one minority opinion. So the Rambam thinks, this is a total non-issue. The fact that the animal developed and was, the girth of the animal was because it ate non-kosher food, or even Isuri Hana, once it's transformed in the body of the animal, so then it's gone. It's gone. And there's nothing even to talk about. So the Shulchan Aruch, who would you expect the Shulchan Aruch to follow? The Rambam. The Shulchan Aruch, in Yoredeyan, Simon Kuf Mem Beis, in Sif Yud Aleph, says, Para, a cow, shenispatma, that was fattened bekarshine avodas kochavim, with legumes of avodazara, te ochel, it may be eaten, v'chein kol kayotzi b'zeh. Now that's not so much of an indicator, because that's based on the Gemara in Avodazara, daf mem tes, that it's talking about a zeh v'zeh goreim. There are other things that the animal is eating. It's not the only thing that the animal is eating. And it's also bidyevet. It doesn't mean that you should feed your animal. You're not allowed to feed your animal isurei hana. You're not allowed to benefit from it. But the Shulchan Aruch says, we follow the Rambam. And the fact that something was raised on feed that was usur, that doesn't matter. But the Shulchan Aruch was written by Rav Yosef Karo, who's following the Sephardic tradition. That's going to follow primarily, heavily influenced by the Rambam. But the Ramah, Rav Moshe Issel, is living in Krakow in the 16th century. He is going to follow the Ashkenazi tradition that's rooted strongly in the Balei HaTosfos. So turn the page. Says the Rama. So if you look in the Nosei Kelim on the Shulchan Aruch there in Kuf Mem Beis, they say, look what the Rama writes earlier in Yoredeyan Siman Samach in the Laws of Trefos. Top of the line, source number 5. Behema mispatva dvar masurim muteris. If the animal was fed with, meaning together with its regular feed, it was fed dvar masurim, things that are prohibited, it's muter. Avol im nispatma kol yomel. If it was fattened its entire life, rak bidvarim asurim, only with prohibited things, asura. It is prohibited. What's the source of this Ramah? You see what they put in the little brackets? Tosfos de Tmura. The Tosfos that we read in Maseches Tmura. So the Ramah accepts the Chiddush of Tosfos. And there's a lot to say, by the way, about the lumdus of why Tosfos thinks this. Rav Shechter Shlita has an explanation here also. But let's just keep it simple. That the Ramah is explaining that as Ashkenazim, we accept the opinion of the Shita of Tosfos, and therefore, if you have a behema that was nispatma kol yomea rak bedvar masurim, its entire life only with Dvarim Asurim, and you see from here, even if it's not Dvarim Asurim Bahana, any Dvarim Asurim, like Trefa, that would be... Okay, so now, you have the Ramah, you have a calf, and if this calf is being fed its entire life, a mixture, which is Basar B'Chalav, not only is it Asur B'Achila, Basar B'Chalav is Asur B'Hana. It's prohibited with Hana. So the thing is that we pointed out that this Tosis is a huge Chiddush, and the Shach, Rav Shabbosai Cohen, one of the greatest giants of the early Acharonim, right? One of the things that we are seeing through the development of this morning is how the Halacha develops. You have a principle that appears in the Mishnah. It's explained by the Gemara, but the Gemara doesn't give you the full parameters. So the Tosis has to give you the parameters in their view. The Rambam gives you the parameters in his view. It's going to filter down between the Ashkenazim and the Sfardim. But after this is codified by the Ramah is only one opinion. It's a major, significant opinion, but the Shach, you have to understand, the Shach, he was like a spiritual, a Torah bulldozer. He lived in the time of the Chmelnytsky massacres. He must have been a plain and simple genius. He ran much of his life. He had a very difficult life because he was running away from pogroms, and he had a photographic memory. He must have had. He describes he used to go from town to town. He would stay somewhere. He would borrow their svarim. He would read the svarim overnight, and then he would go to the next town. And he memorized everything. And the Shach's commentary, which is on the side of the Shulchan Aruch in the Yoridea section, it's massive. And when the Shach gets going against the Ramah, just get out of the way. You do not want to, he's going to quote every Gemara, and every piece that's pertinent to his argument is incredible. So the Shach is very, very significant. So you're talking 17th century. The Shach is on the commentary on the side of the Shulchan Aruch on the outside. The Shach quotes this Ramah, he says, I disagree. He quotes an Isser Heter about the notion, the fact that it is digested, this whole question of digestion, which the Rambam already alluded to in the Pirush HaMishnayos, plus the Chiddush of Tosfos, expanding from Isurei Hana'a to Isurei Achila. And there are others, if you go there on the page in Shulchan Aruch, there are other Achronim who also join on the bandwagon, like the Pri Chadash, the Beis Hillel. There are a bunch of Achronim on the page. They say, we don't accept the Rambam. But the Vilna Gaon does. If you look in the crazy place of Rabbi Yonasan Abish, it's now in the 18th century, he says, you see in source number 6, Das HaShach and the Pei Reish Ches, which is the Pri Chadash, also very early Achron, Davka Shenispatra Bi Isurei Hana. That's only if it was Nispatim with Isurei Hana. Why? Because in Isur Hana, the Shach thinks is going to translate to you benefiting from it if that's fattening the cow. But if it's just an Isur Achila, like you were saying before, worms. The worms, I'm allowed to get benefit from worms. I can feed worms to my animals. There's no Isser Hana. The Shach says the whole issue here is if it's an Isser Hana, it's getting benefit. And then there's a question in the Lumdus, is it direct benefit? Is it indirect benefit? But Lamaisa, I'm getting benefit. So, if you, now let's follow it down. If you are Sephardic, so then the whole origin of this, it's on a faulty premise that you follow Rabbi Hanina ben Antignos, and you certainly wouldn't expand it beyond that. We don't even accept that. If you're Ashkenaz, so according to the Ramah, you got to look at it as a serious problem. According to the Shach, it only depends if it's an Isur Hana. And if it's the full, that's the full measure of what this animal is eating. So now let's bring it back to this veal situation where you have this powder, this formula, which is being fed to the animals. So this becomes an interesting Mitzias question. So first of all, there are several things that we need to think about to figure out, is it Basar B'Chalav? What kind of meat do you think they're using to create the formula to feed the calves?
Horses.
Maybe it's horse meat, possibly. And if it's horse meat, then we're going to be in really good shape because you cannot create Basar B'Chalav Midaraisa with horse meat because it's a behema tumea. Let's assume that it's cow meat for a second, but wait a second. The meat that they're getting in the manufacture of the formula, which is probably not even a farmer, that's probably some factory somewhere, where are they getting their meat? Are they getting glatt kosher meat from Hungarian? No, they're getting nevela meat. Nevela, what is nevela? Nevela is meat of an animal that was not slaughtered according to the halacha. Nevela means an animal which died. It means it died and it didn't get kosher slaughter. So you can have an animal which was shechted, but the knife had a nick in it, so that would also be a nevela. It's not shechted according to the halacha. So if they're getting their meat from some processor, from Tyson or whatever, do they shecht their meat with a shochet? Of course not. So here's the first suggestion. The Rambam has, in the Pirush HaMishnayos, in his commentary on Mishnayos on Krisus, what he calls, ready for this, Nekuda Nifla, an amazing, wondrous idea. We know that there are certain things in halacha that have an iser hana. They are not allowed to provide any benefit, like chametz on Pesach. It's not that you're not allowed to eat chametz, you can't get any benefit from chametz. There are lots of things that are isurei hana. And there are two categories, things that need to be burnt and things that need to be buried or just thrown away. Isur hana. Basar b'cholav is one of those things. You're not allowed to get any benefit from basar b'cholav. However, the Rambam says, wait a second. Basar b'cholav, you're creating an isur hana through the mixture of the milk and the meat, right? So the Rambam says, here is something amazing. And I found it. There's a great explanation. There's a Rav in Gush. His name is Rabbi David Brofsky, who writes a bunch of English halacha svarim. So he explains the Nekuda Nifla in an English that I thought was really good. So I put it on the page for you. Here it's on some North number 7.
That means
Well, okay, so that, let's see exactly this point. When it says, Lo savashal gidi b'chalevi mo, that you are not allowed to cook milk and meat together, what kind of meat are we talking about that creates an isur hana? So take a look at this. The Rambam has this idea. This is how he explains it. I like this language. That although qualitatively, let's start from the top actually, although quantitatively the isur of basar b'chalav is broader, it's broader than nevela. Nevela, a dead animal, you're not allowed to eat. And basar b'chalav, you're also not allowed to get benefit. But the Rambam's chiddush is, qualitatively, they're no different. This is how Rabbi Brofsky uses this language, I thought was interesting. Quantitative versus qualitative. We have a principle, ein iser chalal iser. You can't stack one prohibition on top of another. Now, you can if you are increasing the prohibition. So let's say you have a prohibition which carries eating something that would carry a lav, malchus, and then you add a dimension which also carries kares. Well, you're expanding it. But the Rambam is saying, if you have nevela, adding basar b'chalav, you might say, oh, it's adding an isur hana. No, it's not. He explains. The Rambam presents a nekuda nifla, amazing point which suggests that all isuri achila actually include, by definition, isur hana. In other words, an isur achila is to be viewed as an isur of consumption. Next paragraph. If so, while the isur of basar b'chalav may seem quantitatively broader than the previous isur of nevela, it is actually qualitatively similar. And therefore, the principle of ein iser chalal iser is applicable. In other words, one may, according to the Rambam, benefit from a mixture of nevela and milk. It's actually better to use nevela because by creating a mixture of nevela and milk, you do not create an iser hana'a. You can't add an iser hana'a. So Rav Shechter said that at the meeting, at the OU, Rabbi Ganak asked the milk, the meat processor guys, said, well, can you make the formula out of pork? And they're like, no, Rabbi, it's not kosher. And Rabbi Ganak's like, exactly! Which is much better than nevela. The Rambam's Nekuda Nifla is available, but that's the exact point, which is, ironically, the creation of the Isser Nevea, of the Isser Basar B'chalav, is Novea. It generates from the kosher meat and the kosher milk. The Rambam's Chiddush is that not only is if the meat is not from a kosher animal, but even if the meat itself is not kosher, you can't add on a prohibition of an Isser Hana benefit, because it's already not kosher. So this is the first option. First suggestion is to say that the milk that they're feeding these, the formula that they're feeding these calves, it's actually not Asur and Hana. And the Shach would say that it's permitted.
It's like a double negative.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of like a double negative, ironically. You can't create an Isur Hana because it's already Asur because it's Nevela. That's exactly the Rambam's point. The problem is that many Achronim don't accept this Rambam of the Nekuda Nifla. So that's point number one. Point number two is, wait a second. There is some question, when they started to do some research, is exactly how they manufacture this formula. So what it turned out, apparently, is that they would take a lot of these ingredients, chemicals, and powdered, ground up pieces of this, the lard and the meat and the milk and all that, they would put it in a giant vat, and then they would pour in boiling hot water. Pouring in boiling hot water into a mixture of basur b'chalav. Well, what is that?
Cooking.
Is it cooking? Yeah. Or is it not? So first of all, we have to understand that the only way to have basur b'chalav min ha-Torah, biblical basur b'chalav, is if the two items were cooked together, which is what the Rambam says in source number 8, in Hilchos Machalas Asuras, in the beginning of Perek Tes. V'chein ha'ochel kazayas mishnei mibasav v'cholav shenizbashlu ke'echot loke v'av al pishel lo bishel, says the Magid Mishnah right there on the Rambam. Every time the Torah tells us not to eat milk and meat together, what is the way that is communicated? It says lo sivashel gedi b'chalev imo, which means that even one is for an isra bishel, even cooking it alone, one is for an isra Achila, eating it, and one is for an Isser Hana, enjoying it, benefiting from it. But all of those are only Derech Bishul. If you go to a place and you take a kosher, 100% kosher hamburger, and you have 100% kosher cheese, and you put them on a sandwich together, and you eat that, it is not an Isser D'Oraisa at all. Because the cheese and the milk were not cooked together. So now, the rabbis in the meeting started to think, and the rabbis were doing the research, they said, wait a second. We remember that the din of bishul, of cooking, which has nafkaminas for the laws of Korban Pesach, in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, you couldn't cook your Korban Pesach. It has ramifications for basar b'chalav. You only create basar b'chalav if you cook. And it has ramifications for Hilchos Shabbos. Well, wait a second. In Hilchos Shabbos, when we talk about cooking, we distinguish between what's called kli rishon, first pot on the fire, and kli sheni. So if you look in your little diagram that I put over here for you, the right-hand pot, this came directly off the fire. That's a kli rishon. There's bishul midaraisa in that. The left pot that you're pouring into, that's a kli sheni. So we have a serious question. Is a kli sheni Mavasho, does it cook? So we generally assume that it does not, although there are some exceptions to this. If it's a very, very boiling hot kli sheni, the chayadim, others are machmir that it should be treated as cooking. But wait a second. They told us that they don't take milk and meat and put it in a steam jacket and cook it up in a factory. They said they take the meat and the milk, they put it together, then they pour boiling water on it. So is that cooking? That's an interesting question. That sounds like it might be a shaila of in between kli rishon and kli sheni. It's called irui, pouring. This is a nafkamina for how people make coffee and tea on Shabbos. Assuming that it's not, there's a lot more to say about that, but let's say your teapot, your chayik, your kettle, that's a kli rishon, that's where the water is heating up. Then, when it comes out of that, that's iroi into your cup. Once you fill the cup, that cup is a kli sheni. Some things, kali habishol for Shabbos purposes, cook in a kli sheni. But if you pour that into a third kli, that's a kli shlishi. Rav Moshe Feinstein says nothing cooks in a kli shlishi, even if the water is very hot. So all of a sudden, the Rabbanim started to say, wait a minute, maybe if you do enough digging, you could figure out, maybe this feed, it actually wasn't cooked halachically. It may be boiled, you know, at the end of the day, but if it was cooked in a kli sheni, then it's not going to be basar b'chalav midaraisa. Basar b'chalav is only if it's cooked together. Here comes a third angle. Oh yeah, go ahead. So this is a good question. Is the meat recognizable? So the assumption is that to some extent it is recognizable, although there is a big debate when you take a product and you totally transform it into something else. This is the machlokas haposkim between Achiezer and Rav Aaron Cutler regarding gelatin, where in the case of gelatin, you literally take the bones and crush them into a powder that is unrecognizable and it's nishtana. So Rav Aaron Cutler said that's not nishtana enough to be considered new, whereas Achiezer assumes that it is. Here, I didn't see the exact ingredients, but it seems that it did not get to the level of nishtana. But that is a discussion of nishtana inside the animal itself, that maybe it was nishtana through the digestive process of the animal, the shach based on the Isra v'heter. So here's another wrinkle that goes part of this discussion, which is the Gemara that we alluded to in Avodah Zarah, that on the bottom of the footnote, on the bottom of the page, I wrote, Od yesh lodon be'inyan zevzeh gorim. You also have to don on this issue regarding what we call zevzeh gorim, this and this cause. What do you mean? When these calves are raised, are they only raised on this formula? Some calves, when they are born, they get a few days of mother's milk. Well, then, is that called all of the food? And this brings us to some of the changes that I could see just by doing a little bit of research online in the industry from when this first became a shaila to now, where now, in many cases, many of these calves are allowed or also fed some grain. Well, if they're fed some grain, now it's not kol ma'acholo al yedei the formula. And even further, you should think about, and this is a much bigger discussion, not for today, maybe even you could say within the formula there's zev zeh gorim. This and this are causing. Because in the formula there's lard and tallow and there's milk. But there's also other, they said there's other products in there. So then that's going to create a question of whether or not the other products, let's say if there's a soy product in there, does that become basar b'chalav? Or that helps you create a zevzeh gorim. So if you want more about this topic, there are two excellent articles that were published on this several years ago. I wrote them at the bottom. One is by Rabbi Bleich in Tradition, in the 40th volume of Tradition. And one is by Rabbi Ezra Schwartz and Rabbi Josh Flug in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society, where they deal with these issues with the zevzeh gorim and all these things. But this brings us to, I would say, the initial controversy around veal, from the standpoint that we haven't even dealt with yet, although we alluded to it at the beginning, in terms of how the animals are raised. Because in the days bygone, the way that this went down, apparently, is that these calves were born, and then to keep them really soft, to make sure that there was absolutely no exercise happening at all, they would tether the poor calf in a tiny crate where it couldn't move, and it was raised there for a couple of weeks, and its muscles didn't develop in a normal way at all, and then it was shechted. And this cause, if you look online, there's a huge outcry from animal cruelty activists saying, if you consume veal, you are promoting this type of cruelty to these animals. And this issue of what we call in halacha, tzar balei chayim, was the original issue that Rav Moshe dealt with in his tshuva in the early 1980s. And that's where the metzias seems to have changed. I was looking that according to the American Veal Association, it seems, and you have to check the metzias, but it seems that according to them, their veal producers do not do this anymore, and that they are raised in group homes, whatever they have, it's more covetous now for them. They get out a little more, they play mahjong. I don't know exactly what the metzias is, but they are not raised in the same way that they used to be.
Exactly.
So we have edus that at Romanian they called the veal producer to confirm that this is the case. We'll see in a second that there are others. So this practice was actually, originally, that was the big issue. Keeping these animals in these types of inhumane
conditions, Rav Moshe writes in this tshuva, look on page number 9, Rav Moshe writes, "Be'inyan agolim shemitfatmen osim ba'ofan shebesarim yikabel mara lavan." Regarding the calves, that they fatten them to the extent that their basar, that their meat, their flesh, has a white color. That veal was distinct, not just from its flavor, but from its color. So Rav Moshe writes, he says, they're kept in these terrible conditions, so what's going to happen to the animals? The first concern that Rav Moshe has is it goes back to what we said earlier. What animals look kosher, smell kosher, but are not kosher? Trefas! Animals that develop lesions on their lungs and other kinds of sicknesses. Well, if you take a calf and you tether it in a tiny crate and not let it get out and get any exercise, and it's in this very, you know, terrible environment, how healthy do you think that's going to be? So Moshe says, he says, in his opinion, the biggest concern off the bat of the veal are trefas. So I put in the bold for you. Hakol modim, everybody agrees. You see in the middle of the in where it's bold. Sherubam trefos, the majority of them are trefas. They have all kinds of health problems that cause them to become halachic trefos. Hefuch mecheskas behemos shink sheros, the opposite of the assumption that we make about general cows, that they are kosher. Umashma shurak mitrefos hareya sheroen ze hashochtim midim bedikas hareya. And it seems like it's just because of the trefos in their lungs that people can see when they shech them. Aval efshar ika o trefos b'bnei me'ayim. Maybe they have more intestinal problems. That if, according to Rav Moshe, if they are concerned, that if we have concern that they have intestinal problems, then you have to check the intestines. No one checks the intestines of animals for lesions or things like that for trefus, because we assume that they're okay. Rav Moshe says, well, it comes to veal calves, you should have to check them, because they're raised in this unhealthy way. So how can you trust the kashrus? And therefore, Meharoi haya lesser milasose. It should prohibit this practice. Ubalia nefesh, people who have sensitive spiritual composition. Ein lehu lechol klal me'agolim ke'elu. You should not eat this meat from these calves. Afim yivtku gamma b'nei me'ayim. Even if they check the innards. And he says they didn't check it this way. And without bedikas b'nei me'ayim, you cannot be machshir them. That was Rav Moshe's opinion in 1982 in a letter to his son-in-law, the late Rav Moshe David Tendler, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, just passed away. So Rav Moshe said, these animals are kept in such inhumane conditions, they're going to get sick. And everybody saw. Now, I saw in some of the research, there was a lot of discussion about the fact that they checked and they did not find a higher incidence of trefas in the intestines. They did not find that. So that would be a factual assumption that works out. But this is a very serious issue. That's number one. And then Rav Moshe has an issue with, I put it in the italics here. Vihini le'elu she'osinze, the people who do this, ika vada isur, of what? There is a prohibition of tsar balei chayim, of cruelty to animals. And Rav Moshe says, that's not permitted. Now here too, you could actually debate this issue, because we know that even though there is a prohibition of tzar balei chayim, it is permitted to engage in some level of tzar balei chayim. It's permitted to cause an animal pain for human consumption, for human benefit. Rav Moshe's charge is that this level of benefit does not generate a permission to make these animals suffer. So you could debate that, and Rabbi Bleich goes back and forth, whether or not the type of meat that is veal is substantially different enough that it would generate, like, you couldn't say, you know what, I'm in a bad mood today, I'm just going to take my chicken out and give it a few punches and I'll feel better. That's not tzar balei chayim, which is permitted. Rav Moshe says it has to be for your eating purposes. And Rav Moshe says, well, to make this veal, that's not a justification, just to make the meat white. Others would argue, it's not just that it looks white, that it tastes delicious, and it tastes different, and it has a different market value, and it's these specific calves. So you could argue back and forth on this point. But this creates a whole ethical question of Rav Moshe saying the isser is on the producer, But then you have to ask the question as a consumer, if this is really how it's being produced, so are you aiding and abetting this process by buying it? Like the Gemara has an expression, when a mouse steals cheese, so obviously the Gemara is not letting the mouse off the hook, but the Gemara says, when a mouse steals cheese, you know whose fault it is? The hole. Because if there was no place to hide the cheese, the mouse wouldn't steal it. And it's the same thing in halacha for buying, you know, the stolen, you know, you're walking down in Battery Park. We mentioned the OU offices. You're walking in Battery Park and some guy pulls up in an unmarked car and pulls up the back and he says, oh, do you want to buy a Rolex? It's only $10. So first of all, you should check. I'm not sure it's a real Rolex. But even if it is, why are they selling you the Rolex out of 10? So the Shulchan Aruch has a whole discussion about this. If you're allowed to buy merchandise that you know has a chashash gazela because you're aiding and abetting. So there's an ethical consideration for this. So practically speaking, the Nir Bata Rav, who gives a lot of hashgacha on meat, is a very, very well-known hashgacha, very prominent Talmud Chacham. He wrote a tshuva discussing all of these issues, and they go back and forth. But I saw, to close this out, take a look, Maisa Shahaya, bringing it back to Baltimore. One opportunity we have to come back home. In 2015, there was a special Chol HaMoed trip. Some people go to the amusement park in Chol HaMoed, some people go to the zoo. The late Rabbi Tendler, Zichrono Levracha, went on a Chol HaMoed trip with several of his relatives and the Star K. They went to the Bierig Brothers Shechita plant in Vineland, New Jersey, together with his grandson, Rabbi Shalom Tendler from the Star K, and several of other Rabbanim the Star K. And Rabbi Tendler, Rabbi Dr. Tendler writes, this is from the Star K website, toward the bottom, third to last paragraph, that he was impressed with the health of the animals and the Star K kashrus requirements. The fact that the calves nurse from their mothers after birth, so that's important, because if they're nursing from their mothers, it's not kalma cholo from the feed. Number two, he says, they are group housed instead of caged, and in many cases eat grain as they get older, are very different from the veal of the past, he explained. He said that if these changes could be confirmed industry-wide, the issues that drove the Moshe's psak may possibly be alleviated. And then he goes on to explain the B-Rigs, you can Google them. They have a family meatpacking business in Vineland, New Jersey, which is Ir Ve'im B'Yisrael when it comes to the producers of kosher meat on the East Coast. But the idea that this mitzias, the practical facts on the ground, continue to evolve and are going to inform the halacha are crucial for our understanding of how to view the veal situation. If you're Sephardic, so this is one of those areas where the Sephardim actually are more mekel when it comes to meat. Generally, they are much more machmir. They have to get galat beit Yosef, which is why when you go to Romanian and other places, they have specially designated galat beit Yosef. They're much more machmir than the Ashkenazim. But here, the Sephardim are going to be much more mekel. The Ashkenazim are going to be more machmir because, number one, a kashrus agency is not going to simply say, oh, we're going to rely on the Shach against the Ramah. The Ramah is, and the Vilna Gaon, these are titanic poskim in Ashkenazic tradition. However, if we start to chip away at this and we say, well, wait a second, maybe the feed is not really basa b'chalav in the first place, and then even if it's not even more than the Shach, even according to the Ramah, maybe you can invoke Zevezeh Gorim if they're using their mother's milk also, or if they're also eating grain, and then you have to deal with Ramosha's points where it's not a chashash of treifus because they're being held in much more humane and healthy and sanitary conditions, so then the veal is going to be healthier, and the Tzar Balei Chaim is going to be removed. So the assumption is that places that have reputable hashgachas, like the Nir Bater and the Star K, they took care of these issues. But just that you should be aware, when we read Parsha Shmini, it's not as simple as one's thought when it comes to the kashrus of veal.